It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Secretary joins us to talk about a small business grant program, and the deadline to apply is approaching fast. First, more businesses are reopening, and some people who were laid off or working from home are heading back to their workplaces. And that means that for some parents, it's time to think about sending kids back to childcare. But that can be scary. With the coronavirus still very much present, it can be hard to know what questions to ask of providers, let alone how to talk to kids about why things are different now. Our guests are Jessica Bowden and Dr. Dipesh Navsaria. Jessica Bowden is a certification specialist and early childhood technical consultant at the nonprofit 4C, Coordinated Community Childcare in Madison. She has a bachelor's in early childhood education and worked as a childcare director for 2 years. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Certainly. And Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navsaria, good to have you back with us.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Dr. Navsaria, let's start with a medical clarification. There's been some indication, some ideas out there that it seems to say that children are less likely to get COVID-19 or less likely to suffer from it. What's true here?
Yeah, this can be very confusing. So the best information that we have seems to indicate that children seem to be less likely to spread it amongst the community. They probably can be infected by it at the same rates as everyone else, but they're much more likely to be asymptomatic or have really mild cases that may look as serious as any other cold that's out there. There's a little data showing some unusual inflammatory type of conditions that has been in the news lately. But again, let's remember the number of children that have been hospitalized with COVID-19 or died is a very small number when you consider it in context of really this all people in society or of other threats to kids' health that have always been around.
So certainly concern for our children's health, but really especially concerned that they could pick it up and bring it home to other people who are immunocompromised or older. Is that fair?
Yeah, you know, and that actually was really the thinking behind some of the early closings of early childhood centers as well as schools, was less of a concern that children themselves would come to harm, but they may easily bring it home to adults or siblings or others who may be at higher risk. And let's remember, while it's easy to say, oh, you know, it's only high-risk adults or something like that, that's actually an awful lot of people when you start counting throughout society. So it was really more of a public health kind of population level concern, more than a deep concern about the health of kids themselves being deeply affected.
Jessica, now that we have child care facilities back up and running, there are some precautions they should be taking because of the new coronavirus, and that parents and guardians should take too. What should drop-off look like these days?
Yeah, so drop-off is going to look a little bit different these days. Previously, when children would arrive, the parents would bring children directly to their classroom or into a child care provider's home. So I should preface, there are two different types of child care programs. One is a center-based or a commercial site, and another is a home-based. So some of the precautions are going to look the same in those types of facilities, and some of those things are going to look different. So parents need to take that into consideration as well. But drop-off and arrival and departure are going to look different in that parents may not be entering a home-based program anymore or even their child's classroom. If the classroom has direct access to the outside, parents may be walking their children to the classroom via the outdoors, say their goodbyes, and then the child will go into the classroom and the parent will stay outside. If that's not the case for a facility, there are a couple of measures that have been taken. Some programs are doing staggered drop-off and pick-up times. So parents say, well, I'm going to come at 7:15, and then the next family might come at 7:25. And that's to limit the number of families that are coming in contact with each other. What also may be happening is that parents will either wait in the lobby or in their car, and a teacher or staff member will take the child back to their classroom.
What about hand washing? It's always been important in childcare settings, whether that's home-based or a commercial daycare center. What should caregivers be doing in addition to the usual?
Sure. So some things that we've been seeing now are upon arrival for teachers and children, hands are being washed right away. Of course, you have your usual times after diapering, toileting, before and after meals and things like that. But now as soon as children arrive and teachers arrive, they're getting those hands washed to prevent any germs from the outside from coming into the program. We're also seeing additional hand washing anytime noses are blown or we're touching our hands or our faces or if we're touching something that could be contaminated, making sure that we're getting our hands cleaned.
And Dr. Navsaria, another thing that we have sometimes seen in some settings is mask wearing. We know that it can protect other people from encountering some of the germs that come from the person who's wearing the mask. What would you want to see as far as masks when it comes to childcare?
So I think masks in childcare can be a challenge. So certainly we know that masks decrease transmission if you yourself have the virus or decrease the risk that you might contract it from someone else if they have the virus. So if both sides of the equation, so to speak, are masked, then that does help drop the risk, particularly when you're indoors in confined spaces and things of that nature. So kids that are under two should not be wearing masks. It's really easy for them to possibly get it caught somewhere or have problems with air supply, et cetera, if they're sleeping in turn. And certainly anyone who's sleeping shouldn't have a mask on. I think that we also need to remember that it's really hard for people to keep masks on, and it's even harder for children. I see many examples walking around sometimes of adults. The mask is down below their nose. It doesn't fit very closely and so on. So I think we should think about doing masks, but we should also be extremely patient and recognize that we're putting a pretty large burden on the caregivers, on the early childhood educators, if they have to be continuously being the mask police, so to speak. That can be very wearing for everyone involved.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is a pediatrician. We're talking with him and also with Jessica Bowden, who consults on early childhood for a nonprofit called 4C. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, wondering what you want to know right now. Maybe your circumstances that you have a choice whether your child goes to daycare. What are you weighing? Or maybe your child is already in some sort of care while you go to work or have to care for someone else in your family. Tell us what your situation is like. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Navsaria, though, the other element of masks is that some kids can be scared by them. So there may just even be interaction challenges if everyone is in a mask in a daycare setting.
There certainly can be, although kids do acclimate pretty quickly. I also think that it's okay when a child comes in, maybe on that first day back or something like that, for a teacher particularly that they've known before, right, to pull the mask down briefly and to say, hey, look, it's me, right, just to kind of, you know, allow for that moment of recognition. And I think that's okay. The other thing is that parents can do some prep work to help their children understand what they might be encountering. I think most kids have been asking, you know, why can't I play with my friends? Why can't we see grandma or grandpa or, you know, things like that. There's a number of books on coronavirus. And if you just Google coronavirus books for children, there's articles that summarize some of the best ones out there that help them understand in a developmentally appropriate way that it's not that your teacher or your friends don't love you anymore. It's not that they, you know, are scared of you, etc. That there's some things that will be possible and some things that won't be possible, but there's other ways to show that connection. And I think that can also be very important in helping them just prepare for what they're going to see because it will be different from what they expected.
Yeah, Jessica, how would you recommend daycare workers or people who run in-home childcare talk specifically about those little things like masks or hand washing that are really important, but that are kind of small changes that we're going to have to see?
Yeah, so really being honest with children and letting them know that we need to wear masks, answering children's questions honestly, and then inviting them to ask questions. You can ask them, and of course, it depends on the age of the child, and we want to keep that developmentally appropriate. But allowing for that safe place for children to ask the questions. Once you ask them something, give a moment of pause. Wait for 10 seconds for them to answer so that they can process what question was being asked and they can formulate an answer. Make sure, too, that you're providing that safe space for them to share. And reading books, especially for those really, really young children who don't quite know what's going on. They know there's something different, and they're not sure what that is. If a child asks you a question and you don't know the answer, it's okay to not know, and it's okay to say that you don't know. It's also okay to talk about feelings at this point. This is a really good time to work on some of that emotional development. We want to reassure, we want to make sure that children are feeling okay, but it's okay if there is some of that uncertainty or there's some fear. And helping children recognize that there are a lot of feelings that we can feel, but those feelings can change from time to time and they aren't necessarily permanent. We may see, too, that children are acting out in different ways when they have some of those fears or those feelings that they can't quite verbalize. So we may see some things like extra crying or clinginess or just having a hard time following directions, some challenging behaviors like that. So providers can take that with a grain of salt and work directly with parents so that children are getting communication that it aligns with home and with childcare, and they're not getting mixed information.
We're talking about what questions to ask about coronavirus concerns when we're getting ready to send children back to daycare, when they're in daycare, and how to talk to kids about what's going on. Jessica Bowden is a certification specialist and early childhood technical consultant at the nonprofit 4C. We're also talking with pediatrician Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is your child going to daycare or are you getting ready for a return? What concerns do you have? What questions are you asking? Maybe you're a child care provider. How have you changed your procedures and how hard has that been? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're learning more from our guests as this conversation continues. Maybe hear from you. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we're talking about how to make sure that your child care provider is taking the right precautions to avoid spreading the new coronavirus and how to share that information with kids without scaring them when they don't need to be scared. We're talking with Jessica Bowden, a certification specialist and early childhood technical consultant, and we're also speaking with pediatrician Dr. Dipesh Navsaria. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Share your experience with us during this conversation. We've got Katie from Clinton ready to join in. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had a comment. Are the face shields something that could be used in place of the mask? That way the little ones can actually see the face of the caregiver or the teacher. They can see smiles. It's not quite as scary as a mask.
Katie, thank you for that question. And Dr. Navsaria, are face shields as effective or a good idea right now in childcare settings?
That's a great question, and you're not the first person who's asked me that. So we don't have great data on whether face shields are as effective as masks. Obviously, they sit in front of the face a little bit. There's some air that can get around. But will they actually reduce spread, much of direct spread if someone coughs or sneezes near you or things like that? They certainly could. There are, by the way, masks that have clear areas that are constructed specifically for those who may need to, who lip read and so on. They are much more expensive. So I also worry about early childhood centers sinking money into that at a time when they're already financially under immense stress. I will add that I saw a young child in clinic who, of course, I had a mask and a face shield on. The face shield was to protect the outside of the mask in my eyes. And this is a six-month-old. And, you know, at the end of the visit, I did all my usual laughing, you know, tickling their feet, et cetera. And even when I wasn't touching them and doing the tickling, I still had a lovely social interaction with this child, and there was giggling back and forth and all the things, even though they could only see my eyes. So I do think that being able to see faces is important, but I think there's also many ways in which we as human beings convey things to one another. So hopefully we have better data on the face shield question down the road there. It's just not as clear as we'd like to be yet.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie, for the call. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk about child care, as we reopen, as we have more people back to work and needing child care beyond those critical workers. And we've got Kathy from Wisconsin Dells on the line now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
What's your experience been like?
My comment is that I have 2 4-and-a-half-year-old girls. And I made it a positive experience. So I made sure to, hey, this is how we're going to protect our friends, our family, when we go see them. And I made sure that the masks that I bought for them, they got to pick out, and it's Disney characters. So it made it kind of like an exciting accessory versus something to fear.
Oh, Kathy, thanks so much for sharing how you've handled it with your girls. Jessica, Kathy, they're saying, got to make it a positive experience. Is that what you'd recommend to parents?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. So, the pandemic is scary, but we set the emotional tone for our children. So if we're walking around scared and tense and anxious, children are going to pick up on that, and that's going to be their response. But if we do like Kathy did, and we make this a fun, positive experience, or parts of it can be fun and exciting, getting to choose the mask, talking about keeping our friends safe, even as far as something challenging, like bringing a favorite loved item to a child care center. While that may not be a great idea, some programs are allowing children to choose one item to bring, a comfort object that they can keep at the center for the week that then goes home and get washed. So working with child care programs and your providers to say, how can we make this more of a positive experience? Can my child bring something special to the program with them? Can they choose a special mask if a mask is required at the program?
Oh, how interesting. We've got Jessica Bowden with us, who consults on early childhood for a nonprofit called 4C. And we're also talking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, who's a pediatrician, and we're taking your calls. Kevin from Waukesha has a question for us. Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. We just have a concern about, we have a three-year-old who should be entering 3K this fall, first time going to school, and normally I probably wouldn't be concerned. However, I'm on a medicine that is an immunosuppressant, and we have a newborn coming in July, so should there be anything we can be concerned with him bringing home that could potentially be an issue for us?
Kevin, thanks for the question. And Dr. Navsaria, Kevin is highlighting an issue we all experience, that households are different and different people might have different risks.
So the first thing I'll say is that should probably be a conversation that you have with your own doctor about your own condition and the medication you're on and the dosages you're on and all, and how much of a level of concern that needs to be, because that is so individual. I'll also add that if we were having this conversation last year at this time, or 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, or any other year, there's a lot of viruses that kids bring home from early childhood centers, because that is actually one of their jobs. The immune system develops its long-term memory from being exposed to all these viruses, so kids kind of need to do that. So I think the question is, will this particular virus, is the risk high enough that you would need to alter your plans? Again, that's a conversation to have with your healthcare provider.
And Dr. Navsaria, though, the recommendation being stay 6 feet apart is not how it works for kids.
Hey, the if you can keep kids consistently 6 feet apart, that would be a miracle.
Right. let's fit in one more caller here. Reggie from Oshkosh wants to talk with us. Hi, Reggie.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
My kids are homeschooled, and so staying home hasn't really affected them much, except for all their social activities have been canceled. But the way we keep them socially distancing and wearing their masks is their ninja masks, and we have to be sneaky so we can keep them away from other people. So I don't know if that'll help other people out.
Aha, interesting. Reggie puts on a ninja mask. Jessica, this is the kind of thing you have to figure out how old your kids are, what they can handle, and really connect with them and help them that way, right?
Yeah, for sure. So if your children are old enough to participate in some of that pretend play, that is a great way to encourage your child to wear a mask and make it more of a positive experience versus something that's scary. Maybe the mask is a ninja mask or a superhero mask, and you know, you're keeping yourself safe and you're keeping others safe, and that's your superhero power. Yeah, so keeping that developmentally appropriate is a great way to do that.
How interesting. Thanks for the call again, Reggie, as we are talking with our guests about dealing with childcare. And Dr. Navsaria, one other thing people have been mentioning is taking temperatures. We've got Dave on Facebook who says daycare workers should be COVID tested twice weekly every week. What would your recommendation be when it comes to temperature taking, and what should we be looking for?
So temperature taking simply highlights that there may be an infection. It doesn't tell us what kind of infection, doesn't tell us that they're even infected, but it can be an early screen in case that's the case. I will also add, and this is a challenge for childcare centers that are often small businesses and don't have a lot of backup, but if your staff feel at all ill, they shouldn't be coming to work. Now, I also recognize that creates problems for the center, and it also may create problems in terms of their pay and so on. But we need to try to figure out a way to back up early childhood centers so that staff aren't coming to work sick because they feel they have to work or they you know, need the income and have no other route. As for repeatedly testing people, the problem is that there's still windows of time that that they could still be test negative and still have an issue. And possibly be still about to develop symptoms and so on. So it's not necessarily as much of a panacea as we'd like it to be.
Mm. Lots of questions. Got some of them answered here. Dr. Navsaria, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Jessica, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Bowden is a certification specialist and early childhood technical consultant at the nonprofit 4C, Coordinated Community Child Care in Madison. She has a bachelor's in early childhood education and worked as a child care director for 2 years. And Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and he's president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Coming up after the news, which businesses are and are not eligible for coronavirus relief? We'll talk about it. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the number of high poverty neighborhoods in the U.S. has doubled since 1980. We'll talk with two researchers about the data and why economic growth doesn't benefit all areas equally. First, tomorrow night is the deadline for small Wisconsin businesses to apply for one of 30,000 grants from the state. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation announced the $2,500 grants and We're All In initiative last month. The cash grants draw funding from the federal government's CARES Act to help small businesses bounce back from coronavirus-related hardships. To tell us more about the initiative and what's next, Wisconsin Economic Development Secretary and CEO Missy Hughes joins us. Secretary Hughes, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Let's go over the basics of these grants. Where did you come up with these numbers, $2,500 chunks to 30,000 businesses?
Well, as you mentioned, this funding is coming from the CARES Act, which was part of the overall funding that the state of Wisconsin received from the federal government. And we're able to use some of that funding for economic development. And as we looked at who had been most impacted by the COVID-19 crisis in Wisconsin, it was really those small businesses that were forced to close their doors really early in the game. The restaurants and the cafes and the hairstylists and the barbershops, and had to stay closed really the longest. So earliest and longest, and we wanted to try to help them with some of the expenses that they're incurring now, you know, whether they're needing to restock their inventory or buy PPE for their employees.
Are these are cash grants businesses can use them for anything they need?
That's right. They're cash grants with no requirements on how they use the expenses.
So which businesses, certainly, which businesses are eligible for these grants?
So if you're a for-profit business that's based in Wisconsin, you have up to 20 employees and less than $1 million in annual revenue, you're eligible for this grant.
So anyone outside of that, if your business doesn't fit those exact parameters, this is not the grant for you?
Yeah, but I think, you know, really you should visit our website at wedc.org and look at the eligibility requirements, because we still have about 10,000 available applications. So we've got about 20,000 applications in the door completed, and we're looking for 30,000 grants. So my goal is to get folks to look at our website and see if they're eligible. And if they are, go ahead and apply.
We'll make sure there's a link to that on WPR.org/Central Time. And that that goal, having that goal, I mean, the deadline is tomorrow night at 11:59. Do you think you'll be able to get 10,000 businesses to apply for those grants in that time frame?
Well, we have a number of businesses that have already started their application process. And so, you know, we're edging towards it. But my goal would be to be oversubscribed and have more applicants than we have grants for. So, you know, then we can have a conversation with the administration or with the legislature about potentially more funds. But first and foremost, I want to make sure we get these dollars out onto the street.
And WEDC, we announced earlier today that there was still room for those 10,000. And if you don't reach your cap, will the grant winners get additional funds? Would you extend the deadline? How would you deal with that?
Well, we're not able to increase the funds of the grants because those have been approved by our board and by the administration. But what we might do is we might reopen the grant process and invite folks to apply, you know, in a secondary grant process. But really our hope is we've done a lot of work. We've got everything set up. Let's get those applications in and get them in hand. And, you know, I think right now businesses are hearing so much news, there's so much information coming at them that by the time they see a grant, you know, they get an email or something like that, they're like, oh, that's probably gone already. But the reality is there's still availability here, so we want folks to apply.
Missy Hughes is Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, and we're talking about a grant program to help small businesses dealing with coronavirus-related hardships, and we're talking about it ahead of the deadline, which is Tuesday night. And Secretary Hughes, a news release we have mentioned some businesses have submitted incomplete or inaccurate applications. Are you giving those businesses an opportunity to fix their applications?
Yeah, we are. Thank you. We're going to be sending emails back to folks who have a problem with their application and letting them know that they need to reapply. So it's really important if you get that email that there's something incorrect, that you go ahead and reapply. We also have live folks available to help with questions at WEDC. So if folks want to reach out to us with questions, we're available to help work those through. But really, the application process is pretty straightforward. We tried to make it as simple and straightforward, knowing that, you know, people have had to deal with a lot of paperwork in the last few months, and we didn't want to add to it. So we tried to make it as simple as possible.
What have you heard back from small businesses about this program, or I guess more broadly during this time?
You know, mostly I've heard small businesses saying it's been really tough, but we're going to make it through. We just really can't have this go on for really too long. You know, through the summer or something like that would have been really devastating for these businesses. And that's why it's really important. The reason this is called We're All In is because we're all in this together. And we need to be taking care as consumers of these small businesses, you know, our Main Street businesses that were closed. We need to go back out and you know, buy a gift card or buy somebody a present or go sit in their cafe or sit outside their cafe, whatever's available right now. But we need to be working all together to keep the virus, keep flattening that curve on the virus, and keep buying local and supporting each other.
$2,500 sounds like a lot of money. And then I think about running a business and I think $2,500 doesn't go very far. How do you see these grants fitting into a greater economic recovery?
Well, the first thing is that these grants are not loans. So there's no strings attached. It's basically a grant that you can use for whatever you need to pay for right now. And it's not going to save businesses, but it's really meant to try to help find another way to bridge some of the gaps in financing that our small businesses are experiencing during this time.
And what other tools are you recommending for small businesses to tap into right now?
Well, the Small Business Administration, we've heard, you know, about the PPP program and other programs. The SBA still has quite a few tools available. And so after you finish your applications at WEDC.org, I would encourage businesses to go to the Small Business Administration's website, which is SBA.gov, and explore some of the tools that they have available, because they've waived fees, they've made payments, they've waived payments for the first 6 months. So there's a lot that they've done to make those typical programs really palatable in this time. So if you're needing to manage your cash flow or you have some concerns, SBA.gov is a great place to go. And we have small business development centers at all of the system schools, all of our colleges around the state, and those SBDCs are ready to help small businesses explore what their options might be.
And how do you talk to small business owners as we are thinking about advancement, risk-taking, innovation, important to you, when some are just trying to keep their heads above water right now?
Yeah, right now I'm doing mostly listening rather than talking, because, you know, to hear what businesses have gone through really helps inform me and the administration about what kind of tools they need to recover. And so we'll keep talking to small businesses and learning how we can help, what they're thinking about, what's on their mind, because that's really where the solutions are going to come from.
But how does innovation actually play into what happens next with these businesses? Because I think many businesses are not operating the same way now than they did just a few months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most important innovations that especially just your regular small business needs to be thinking about is having an online presence. If you think about if you have a retail shop and someone and you want to sell your business, and you're able to say, not only do I have this physical location, but I have a robust online business also, it doubles the value of your business. So, you know, that, and it provides flexibility and diversity in a time like this. So it's definitely one thing that we're thinking about. How do we support small businesses in creating their online presence?
And what do you say to someone who's been thinking about starting a small business and thought now would be the time? Is it still?
You know, I've heard two different things. One I've heard is that, you know, this kind of an economic hit makes people very risk averse. And then I've heard people say that it's times like this when people go out and say, hey, I'm going to be scrappy and I'm going to make my own business because I lost my job at the big company or I lost my job at the restaurant. So I would encourage folks to be scrappy. And there's lots of resources out there. Every community, one of the things that I've learned since coming on this job is the support system in every community is really impressive. And so finding out from your chamber or your local economic development folks what kind of support there is and tapping into that, I think, is how I would go about starting a small business right now.
And Secretary Hughes, what is the next phase of this We Are All In initiative?
Well, once we're done with the application process, we're going to have a group of companies and businesses all around the state that we want to work with, and then other companies and other businesses and communities to amplify this idea that we're all in this together. Because for all of the diversity and discrepancy that we have in Wisconsin, we'd like to take care of each other. We'd like to take care of our neighbors, and we're all in this together. You know, we're concerned about what's going to happen in the fall. And it's really important that we all think about each other and taking care of each other.
All right. We'll watch for details on that then. Secretary Hughes, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Missy Hughes is Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We talked with her today about a statewide small business coronavirus recovery grant initiative called We're All In. The deadline for applications is tomorrow night at 11:59, and you can find a link on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up next, research finds the number of high poverty neighborhoods in America doubled over the last 40 years. We're taking a closer look at it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. The amount of high poverty neighborhoods in the U.S. has doubled since 1980, and so has the number of people living in those areas. That's according to data from the Economic Innovation Group's Neighborhood Poverty Project. It looks into household income in metropolitan areas, what that means for where people live, and whether economic growth translates into fewer neighborhoods with high rates of poverty. August Benzo is a research and policy analyst at the Economic Innovation Group and joins us now. August, good to have you with us.
Hi, good to be here.
And Kenan Fikri is the research director for EIG. Kenan, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Kenan, we got to define some terms here. How are you defining high poverty and low poverty neighborhoods in your research?
Sure. So we define high poverty neighborhoods as census tracts that have a poverty rate of 30% or higher. So that just means 30% of households in the neighborhood live under the poverty line or more. And then we define low poverty neighborhoods as those in which under 20% of the population is under the poverty line. And then we break up that high poverty category to understand a little better how those neighborhoods have evolved over the past 40 years into three different buckets. So one group is persistently poor. Those ones were high poverty in 1980. They were still high poverty in 2018. Newly poor neighborhoods are ones that were low poverty in 1980, but have since undergone pretty dramatic decline and had become high poverty by 2018. And then the last group is deepening poverty, where they had elevated poverty levels in 1980, and by 2018 they had crossed that high poverty threshold. And then, of course, we were curious, you know, how many neighborhoods are going in the opposite direction? We have, we clearly documented a large number of neighborhoods kind of downwardly mobile in the U.S., but how many were turning around and really rebounding strongly? So we looked at the number of neighborhoods that were high poverty in 1980 and moved to low poverty by 2018, called them turnaround neighborhoods, only about 14% of neighborhoods that were high poverty in 1980 had become low poverty today. And that struck us as a really dramatically small number of places that have rebounded over the course of, you know, decades of economic growth.
14%.
14%. 464 neighborhoods as opposed to over 6,500 neighborhoods that are considered high poverty today.
August, what are demographic trends that stuck out to you about who's living in high poverty neighborhoods?
Kind of zooming in on Wisconsin as a sort of microcosm of the rest of the country, because it really does vary based on state and region. But Wisconsin, like a lot of the Midwest, has really a high share of people of color living in these high poverty neighborhoods. If you just look at Milwaukee, for example, where about 80% of Wisconsin's high poverty neighborhoods are located, the overwhelming majority of 87% of the population in those high poverty neighborhoods is non-white. Especially in the case of Milwaukee, it's overwhelmingly African American. That's a trend that's really persisted from 1980 to today. In fact, the share of the Milwaukee's black population living in a high poverty neighborhood increased from 45% in 1980 to 57% in 2018.
August, do we know what causes that?
What's driving that in Milwaukee in a large part is just the sheer increase in high poverty neighborhoods, which almost tripled from 31 in 1980 to 2018 to 91 in 2018, of course there's a lot of underlying causes of that as neighborhoods kind of flip from being relatively stable low poverty to becoming high poverty, even during periods of economic growth. This is often driven by a lack of economic opportunities for people, and sort of hollowing out of the middle class, which has been talked a lot about.
Yeah. We're talking with August Benzo and Kenan Fikri, researchers with the Economic Innovation Group. They found that in a nearly 40-year period, the number of high-poverty neighborhoods in the U.S. doubled. And Kenan, with almost 40 years of data that you looked at, there were two big economic expansions in the 1990s and then as we recovered from the Great Recession. And yet I've heard both you and August say that doesn't seem to make a difference when it comes to the poverty, the number of places that we see with people living in poverty. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that I think is fundamental to kind of charting a new course out of the current crisis, which hopefully can provide a reset for a lot of trends and longstanding problems that the country's had are lying there waiting to be solved. Back in the 1990s, so that was an expansion that looked a lot more equitable than the one that we're coming out of here in the 2010s. Coming out of the urban crisis of the 1980s, right, the 1990s expansion really meaningfully reduced the number of high poverty neighborhoods in the United States. Poor neighborhoods or income was growing faster in poor neighborhoods than it was in wealthy neighborhoods, which is what you want to see if you're trying to, you know, use economic growth to increase inequality. But then come the 2010s, all that progress stopped in the 2000s. And I'd say the 2000s was a bit of a culprit, and then the 2010s was the missed opportunity to make progress. Over the course of the 2000s, we really saw the country's manufacturing base erode and the middle class hollow out. That translated into spatial terms, into the neighborhoods where these people lived who lost a good manufacturing job and had to trade down to something else. And we saw a really dramatic increase in the suburbanization of poverty and in kind of poverty moving out of the traditional inner city strongholds into, you know, first tier suburbs, aging suburbs, just the spaces in between the city center and the new greener suburbs. So all that happened over the course of the 2000s. And then, of course, the Great Recession hit in the 2010s. And the period after that coming out was really the most geographically unequal expansion the country's ever had at any scale that you want to look at, be it, you know, a superstar metro area versus an industrial heartland, or even within cities. You saw that wealthy areas were just garnering far more of the fruits and benefits of that expansion than poor areas, largely because it was a recovery that favored, you know, highly educated individuals and white-collar professions that didn't offer much until the very latter stages for low-income workers or blue-collar workers. And of course, you know, that tape has since played out, and now we're entering into what could be another economic depression that's really hit our most vulnerable employees, workers, and communities, you know, harder than it has the wealthier areas that have a bit more, you know, fortification and resiliency and, you know, a rainy day fund to fall back on.
And this coronavirus pandemic put a stop to that economic growth we were seeing. The U.S. is now officially in a recession. August, what are you watching as this downturn takes shape?
Recent study from Columbia University found that, according to their estimates, that the national poverty rate is not really increasing that much yet, which has a lot to do with the CARES Act, which really put a lot of money quickly into people's hands in terms of both the stimulus checks and the extended unemployment benefits. But the stimulus checks were a one-time deal, and those unemployment benefits are not expected to be renewed currently. So what we're looking for is a more long-term impact. Once that sort of federal aid begins to dry up a bit and we have to pivot to kind of new solutions as the impacts of the COVID recession begin to kind of trickle down into places and impact stuff like business formation and entrepreneurial opportunities and kind of start to nudge places that were stable into a more unstable position. So really just kind of looking at the data and seeing what kind of trends we can pick out that might indicate that places are starting to struggle a bit more than they were, which is a process that could take quite a bit of time.
Sure. And I want to thank August and Kenan. We're a bit short on time, but we appreciate the time you took with us. Kenan Fikri is Research Director for the Economic Innovation Group, and August Benzo is a Research and Policy Analyst for EIG. They talked with us about their work on the Neighborhood Poverty Project, which found that the number of high poverty neighborhoods has increased. You may notice more people wearing masks in public now. NPR reports that more scientific studies are showing face coverings are a crucial way to slow the spread of the new coronavirus. Evidence shows it protects other people, especially from your germs. You can see so many styles and patterns. There are seemingly infinite options for fabric. And that has some people taking a realistic approach to masks. You can get a mask printed with the bottom part of your own face on it. That way, it looks like you. Sort of. NASCAR fans saw driver Denny Hamlin put on a mask that made it look like he was smiling last month when he won a race at Darlington. And while it was him, it also didn't quite look like him. If that's the route you want to go, you do you. I think I'll stick to my brightly colored masks for now, a bonus if one coordinates with the clothes I'm wearing. Maybe I'll branch out to the star pattern my mother-in-law just sewed for the 4th of July because, you know, it's hard to resist a theme. But for now, I'll wait on getting my face printed on my face mask. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.